Chapter 37. Nothing to be scared about. 2001. When Deborah got to her doctor's office, her blood pressure and blood sugar were so high, her doctor was amazed she hadn't had a stroke or heart attack while we were in Clover. With levels like hers, he said, she could still have one any minute. Suddenly, her strange behavior on the trip seemed less strange. Confusion, panic, and incoherent speech are all symptoms of extremely high blood pressure and blood sugar, which can lead to heart attack and stroke. So is redness and swelling, which could explain why her red welts didn't go away despite all the Benadryl she drank. The doctor told her she needed to avoid stress completely. So we decided she should stop coming on research trips with me. But she insisted I call her from the road to tell her what she was missing. For the next several months, as I continued my research, I told Deborah only the good things I found. Stories about Henrietta dancing and watching the boys play baseball at Cliff's house. Details about her family history from county records and wills. But we both knew the break from Gila wouldn't last. Deborah was still scheduled to give a talk at the National Foundation for Cancer Research Conference in honor of Henrietta. She was determined to do it, even though she was terrified by the idea of getting up on stage. So she started spending her days planning her speech. One afternoon, in the midst of preparing for the conference, she called me to say she'd decided she wanted to go to school. I keep thinking, maybe if I understood some science, then the story about my mother and sister wouldn't scare me so much, she said. So I'm just going to do it. Within days, she'd called several local community centers and found one that offered adult education classes and signed up to take math and reading placement tests. Once I get a 10th grade level, I'm ready to go on to college, she told me. Can you imagine? Then I can understand all that science about my mother. She thought about becoming a dental assistant, but was leaning toward radiation technologist so she could study cancer and help patients who were getting radiation treatment like her mother. As the conference approached, Deborah was calm, but I wasn't. I kept asking, "Are you sure you want to do this?" And, "How's your blood pressure?" And, "Does your doctor know you're doing this?" She kept telling me she was fine, that even her doctor said so. Deborah took her placement tests for school and registered for the classes she'd need to get herself up to 10th grade level and qualify for the community college classes she wanted to take. She called me giddy, screaming, "I start a week from today!" But everything else seemed to be spiraling in the wrong direction. A few days before the conference, Lawrence and Zakaria called yelling again about how she shouldn't talk to anyone and saying they wanted to sue every scientist who'd ever worked on Henrietta's cells. Sonny told them to stay out of it, saying, "All she doing now is going places to speak and learn. Y'all don't want to do that, so just leave her alone." But Lawrence insisted Deborah give him the records she'd gathered on their mother. Then her son Alfred called from prison, saying he'd finally be going on trial right after the conference, and the charges now included armed robbery and attempted murder. That same day, Deborah got a call about one of Lawrence's sons who'd been arrested for robbery and was in the same jail as Alfred.
"The devil's been busy, girl," she told me. "I love them boys, but I'm not going to let nobody upset me right now."
The next morning was September 11th, 2001. I called Deborah around 8 in the morning saying I was leaving my home in Pittsburgh and headed to the conference in Washington, D.C. Less than an hour later, the first plane hit the World Trade Center. A reporter friend called my cell phone and told me the news, saying, "Don't go to D.C., it's not safe." I turned my car around as the second plane hit. And by the time I got home, the TV was filled with footage of the Pentagon's wreckage and buildings throughout D.C. being evacuated, including the Ronald Reagan Building,
where the conference reception to honor Henrietta was supposed to be held. I called Deborah, and she answered in a panic.
"It's just like Pearl Harbor all over again," she said.
"And Oklahoma? There's no way I'm going to D.C. now." But there was no need. With airlines and Washington shut down, the NFCR canceled the Henrietta Lacks conference with no plan to reschedule. For the next several days, Deborah and I talked many times as we both struggled to make sense of the attacks, and Deborah tried to accept the idea that the conference had been canceled. She was depressed and worried that it would take another 10 years for someone to honor her mother. Then, on Sunday morning, 5 days after September 11th, Deborah went to church to pray for Alfred, whose trial was only a few days away, and to ask that the Henrietta Lacks conference be rescheduled. She sat in the front pew in a red dress, hands folded in her lap, listening to her husband preach about September 11th. About an hour into the service, Deborah realized she couldn't move her arm. Davon, who was now 9 years old, always sat in the choir and watched his grandmother during church. For a moment, as Deborah's face began to sag and her body slumped, Davon thought maybe she'd accidentally taken her sleeping pill before coming to church. Deborah saw his little eyes watching her, and she tried to wave, to tell him something was wrong, but she couldn't move. At the end of the service, the congregation stood and Deborah's mouth twisted as she fought to scream. The only sound came from Davon, who yelled,
"Something's wrong with my grandma!"
He sprinted from the choir platform just as Deborah fell forward onto one knee. Davon screamed,
"Grandpop! Grandpop!"
Pullum took one look at Deborah and yelled,
"Stroke!"
The second Davon heard the word stroke, he grabbed Deborah's pocketbook, dug out her car keys, and ran to the car. He opened all the doors wide, laid the passenger seat back as flat as it would go, and jumped behind the wheel, feet dangling far above the pedals. Then he started the engine so Pullum could just climb in and start driving. Soon they were speeding along the winding road from church, Deborah slipping in and out of consciousness in the passenger seat, while Davon leaned over her, screaming,
"Don't you go to sleep, Ma!"
and slapping her hard across the face every time she closed her eyes. Pullum kept yelling for him to stop, saying,
"Boy, you gonna kill your grandma!"
But Davon wouldn't stop. When they got to the fire station down the road, medics pulled Deborah from the car, gave her oxygen and injections, ran an IV to her arm, and loaded her into an ambulance. As the ambulance drove away, a fireman told Davon he was smart to smack Deborah in the car.
"Boy, you did your grandmother a favor," the fireman said. "You just saved her life."
One of the first things Deborah said when she regained consciousness was,
"I have to take a test."
The hospital staff thought she meant she needed a CT scan or a blood test, but she meant a test for school. When the doctors finally let Deborah's family see her, Davon, Pullum, and Deborah's daughter Tonya filed in to find Deborah sitting propped up in bed, eyes wide, tired but alive. Her left side was still weak, and she couldn't move her arms well. But the doctor said she was lucky and would probably recover completely.
"Praise the Lord," Pullum yelled.
A few days later, when Deborah got out of the hospital, she left me a voicemail. It was my birthday, and we'd planned to meet in Clover that day.
"Happy birthday, Boo," she said,
her voice utterly calm.
"I'm sorry I can't come celebrate with you down in the country, but I had me a couple strokes the other day. It was bound to happen, but praise the Lord, I'm okay. Can't talk too good out one side of my mouth, but doctors say I'm gonna be fine. You keep reporting. And don't you worry about me. I feel good. Better than since before I found out they took my mother's cells. I feel so light, you know? It lifted my burden. I thank the Lord for what happened.
The doctor told Deborah a second stroke was almost always worse than the first.
Trust me, he said. You don't want to do this again.
He told her she needed to educate herself, learn the warning signs, know how to bring down her blood pressure and control her blood sugar.
Just another reason I got to keep going on and get to school, she told me.
I already signed up for a diabetes class and a stroke class to get more understanding about that.
Maybe I can take a nutrition class to learn how to eat good, too.
The stroke seemed to ease tension in the family, too. Deborah's brothers began calling every day to see how she was doing, and Zakaria even said he wanted to visit. Deborah hoped this meant her brothers would find peace with her desire for information about their mother. She called me laughing, saying,
Girl, I got to get my rest so we can get back on the road and do more research before the trail get cold. But from now on, I ride with you. Everything will be all right. That's what I woke up knowing. I just got to move a little slower, pay attention to things, and not let myself get scared. 'Cause there's nothing to be scared about with my mother and them cells. I don't want nothing to keep me from learning no more.
But in fact, there was something that would keep Deborah from learning. She didn't have enough money. Her Social Security check barely covered her living expenses, let alone classes and books. She came up with several ideas for making money, including a colorful disposable baby bottle with pre-measured amounts of water and formula, something a busy mom could shake with one hand while holding a baby. She drew careful diagrams and sent them off with a patent application. But she dropped the idea when she found out it would cost several $1,000s to make the prototype. Eventually, Deborah stopped thinking about going to school herself and instead started focusing on making sure her grandchildren and grandnieces and grandnephews got educated.
It's too late for Henrietta's children, she told me one day over the phone. This story ain't about us no more. It's about the new Lax children.
2 months after Deborah's stroke, we went to Pullum's church to watch him baptize Sonny's 9-month-old baby granddaughter, Jabrea. There was hardly an empty seat when the sermon started. Pullum stood behind the pulpit, wrapped in a long black robe with red crosses on its front, sweat beading his forehead. A blind piano player tapped his way to the piano and began to play as the congregation sang along, "Stand by me while I run this race, for I don't want to run this race in vain." Pullum pointed at me and grinned a mischievous grin.
"Come stand by me," he yelled.
"Ooh, girl, you in trouble now," Deborah whispered, elbowing me in the ribs.
"I am not going up there," I whispered back. "Just pretend like we can't see him." Pullum waved his arms over his head, then pointed at the pulpit for me to join him. Deborah and I stared at the choir behind him, our faces blank, pretending not to see. Pullum rolled his eyes, then yelled into the microphone,
"We have a guest with us today, Rebecca Skloot. Would you stand for us this morning?"
Deborah whispered, "Uh-oh," as the entire congregation followed his pointing finger to look at me. I stood.
"Sister Rebecca Skloot," Pullum said. "I know this might not be the right time for you, but it's the right time for me." "Amen," Deborah said from her seat beside me,
her voice suddenly serious.
"John Hopkins took my wife's mother's body and used what they needed," he yelled into the microphone. "They sold her cells all over the world. Now I'm gonna have Sister Rebecca Skloot
come and talk about what she doing with my wife and themselves.
I'd never sat in a congregation before, let alone spoken in front of one. My face flushed and my throat clenched as Deborah pushed my back to get me moving. Pullum told the congregation to give me a hand, and the room erupted in cheers. I walked to the pulpit and took the microphone from Pullum, who patted me on the back and whispered in my ear, "Just preach it in your own words." So I did. I told the story of Henrietta's cells and what they'd done for science, my voice growing louder as the congregation yelled Amen and Hallelujah and Lord have mercy. "Most people think her name was Helen Lane," I said, "but she was Henrietta Lacks. She had 5 children, and one of them is sitting right over there." I pointed at Deborah. She was holding Jabrea in her lap now, grinning, tears streaming down her cheeks. Pullum stepped forward and took the microphone, putting his arm around my shoulders and squeezing so I wouldn't walk away.
"I was very angry with Sister Rebecca when she started calling us," he said. "So was my wife. Then finally we said okay, but we told her, 'You need to talk to us like we're regular folk. You need to tell us what's going on.'"
Then he looked at Deborah.
"The world gonna know who your mother is, for you and Sonny and the rest of Henrietta's children. They probably won't see real benefits from those cells."
Deborah nodded as Pullum raised his long-robed arm and pointed to Jabrea, a breathtakingly beautiful baby dressed in white lace with a bow in her hair.
"This child will someday know that her great-grandmother Henrietta helped the world," Pullum yelled.
Then he pointed around the room at Davon and Jabrea's other cousins, saying,
"So will that child, and that child, and that child. This is their story now. They need to take hold of it and let it teach them they can change the world, too."
He raised his arms above his head and yelled Hallelujah. Baby Jabrea waved her hands and let out a loud, happy screech, and the congregation yelled Amen. Chapter 38, The Long Road to Clover, 2009. On January 18th, 2009, on a cold, sunny Sunday, I pulled off the highway onto the road into Clover. As I passed one green field after the next, I thought, I don't remember the road into Clover being so long. Then I realized I just passed the Clover post office. It was across the street from a big empty field. But it used to be across the street from the rest of downtown. I didn't understand. If that was the post office, where was everything else? I kept driving for a moment, thinking, did they move the post office? Then it hit me. Clover was gone. I jumped out of the car and ran into the field, to the spot where the old movie theater once stood, where Henrietta and Cliff once watched Buck Jones films. It was gone. So was the Gregory and Martin's grocery and Abbott's clothing store. I stood with my hand over my mouth, staring in disbelief at the empty field until I realized there were splinters of brick and small white plaster tiles pressed into the dirt and grass. I knelt down and began collecting them, filling my pockets with what remained of the town of Henrietta's youth. I have to send some of this to Deborah, I thought. She's not going to believe Clover is gone. Standing on Main Street, staring at the corpse of Clover's downtown, it felt like everything related to Henrietta's history was vanishing. In 2002, just 1 year after Gary had wrapped his hands around Deborah's head and passed the burden of the cells onto me, he'd died suddenly at the age of 52 from a heart attack. He'd been walking toward Cootie's car,
carrying his best suit to put in the trunk so it wouldn't get wrinkled on the way to Cootie's mother's funeral. A few months later, Deborah called to say that Cliff's brother Fred had died from throat cancer. Next, it was Day, who died of a stroke, surrounded by his family. Then Cootie, who killed himself with a shotgun to the head. Each time someone died, Deborah called crying. I thought the calls would never end.
"Death just following us in this story everywhere we go," she'd say. "But I'm hanging in there."
In the years that followed the baptism, not much changed for the Laxes. Babette and Lawrence went on with their lives. Lawrence didn't think about the cells much anymore, though occasionally he and Zakaria still entertained the idea of suing Hopkins. Sonny had a quintuple bypass in 2003 when he was 56 years old. The last thing he remembered before falling unconscious under the anesthesia was a doctor standing over him saying his mother's cells were one of the most important things that had ever happened to medicine. Sonny woke up more than $125,000 in debt because he didn't have health insurance to cover the surgery. Zakaria got kicked out of his assisted living facility, then a Section 8 housing project, where he smashed a 40-ounce beer bottle over a woman's back and pushed her through a plate glass window. He sometimes worked with Sonny, driving a truck. In 2004, Deborah left her husband and moved into an assisted living apartment of her own, which she'd longed to do for years. She was tired of fighting with Pullum. Plus, their row house had too many stairs. After she moved out, to cover her bills, she went to work full-time for her daughter Tonya, who opened an assisted living home in her house. Each morning, Deborah left the assisted living facility where she lived and spent the day cooking and cleaning for the 5 or 6 men living in her daughter's home. She quit after 2 years because her body couldn't take walking up and down stairs all day. When Deborah officially divorced Pullum in 2006, she had to itemize her income as part of a request for the judge to waive her filing fee. She listed $732 per month from Social Security disability and $10 per month in food stamps. Her checking account was empty. When I went back to visit Clover and found Main Street razed, it had been a few months since Deborah and I talked. During our last call, I told her that the book was done, and she'd said she wanted me to come to Baltimore and read it to her, so I could talk her through the hard parts. I'd called several times since to plan the visit, but she hadn't returned my calls. I left messages, but didn't push her. She needs some space to prepare herself, I thought. She'll call when she's ready. When I got home from Clover, I called again, saying, "I brought something back for you from Clover. You won't believe what's happened down there." But she didn't call back. On May 21st, 2009, after leaving many messages, I called again. Her voicemail box was full. So I dialed Sonny's number to say something I'd said to him many times over the years. "Will you tell your sister to stop messing around and return my calls? I really need to talk to her. Our time is running out." When he answered the phone, I said, "Hey, Sonny, it's Rebecca." And for a moment, the line went silent.
"I've been trying to find your phone number," he said,
and my eyes filled with tears. I knew there was only one reason Sonny would need to call me. Deborah had gone over to her niece's house on Mother's Day, a week and a half before my call. Sonny had made crab cakes for her. The grandchildren were there, and everyone laughed and told stories. After dinner, he took Deborah back to the apartment she loved and said goodnight. She stayed home the next day, ate the leftover crab cakes Sonny sent home with her, and talked to Davon on the phone. He was learning to drive and wanted to come over in the morning to practice. The next morning when he called, she didn't answer. A few hours later, Sonny dropped by to check on her.
as he did nearly every day, and found her in her bed, arms crossed on her chest, smiling. He thought she was sleeping, so he touched her arm, saying,
"Dale, time to get up."
But she wasn't sleeping.
"She's in a better place now,"
Sonny told me.
"A heart attack, just after Mother's Day. She wouldn't have wanted it another way. She suffered a lot in life, and now she's happy."
After finding Deborah in her bed, Sonny cut a lock of her hair and tucked it inside their mother's Bible with the locks of hair from Henrietta and Elsie.
"She's with them now,"
he told me.
"You know there's no place in the world she'd rather be."
Deborah was happy when she died. Her grandson, little Alfred, was now 12, headed into the 8th grade and doing well in school. Lawrence and Bobette's granddaughter, Erica, had gotten into Penn State after writing an admissions essay about how her great-grandmother Henrietta's story had inspired her to study science. After transferring to the University of Maryland, she earned her bachelor's degree and entered a master's program in psychology, becoming the first of Henrietta's descendants to attend graduate school. At 17, Deborah's grandson, Davon, was about to graduate from high school. He'd promised Deborah he'd go to college and continue learning about Henrietta until he knew everything there was to know about her.
"That really made me feel okay about dying whenever my time come,"
she'd told me. As Sonny told me the news of Deborah's death, I sat staring at a framed picture of her that's been on my desk for nearly a decade. In it, her eyes are hard, her brow creased and angry. She's wearing a pink shirt and holding a bottle of pink Benadryl. Everything else is red. Her fingernails, the welts on her face, the dirt beneath her feet. I stared at that picture for days after her death as I listened to hours of tape of us talking and read the notes I'd taken the last time I saw her. At one point during that visit, Deborah, Davon, and I sat side by side on her bed, our backs to the wall, legs outstretched. We'd just finished watching two of Deborah's favorite movies back to back, Roots and the animated movie Spirit, about a wild horse who's captured by the U.S. Army. She wanted us to watch them together so we could see the similarities between the two. "Spirit fought for his freedom just as Kunta Kinte did in Roots," she said.
"People was always trying to keep them down and stop them from doing what they want, just like people always doing with me and the story about my mother," she said.
When the films ended, Deborah jumped out of bed and put in yet another video. She pressed play, and a younger version of herself appeared on the screen. It was one of nearly a dozen tapes the BBC had recorded that didn't make it into the documentary. On the screen, Deborah sat on a couch with her mother's Bible open in her lap, her hair brown instead of gray, her eyes bright, with no circles beneath them. As she talked, her hand stroked the long lock of her mother's hair.
"I often visit her hair in the Bible," Deborah said into the camera. "When I think about this hair, I'm not as lonely. I imagine, what would it be like to have a mother to go to laugh, cry, hug? God willing, I can be with her someday. I'm looking forward to that."
The younger Deborah said she was glad that when she died, she wouldn't have to tell her mother the story of everything that happened with the cells and the family, because Henrietta already knew.
"She's been watching us and seeing all that's going on down here," Deborah said. "She's waiting patiently for us. There won't be any words, just a lot of hugging and crying. I really believe she's up in heaven, and she's doing okay,
because she did enough suffering for everyone down here. On the other side, they say there's no pain or suffering. I want to be there with my mother.
Sitting between me and Davon on the bed, Deborah nodded at her younger self on the screen and said,
Heaven looks just like Clover, Virginia. My mother and I always loved it down there more than anywhere else in the world.
She stroked Davon's hair.
I don't know how I'm going to go, she said. I just hope it's nice and calm. But I tell you one thing. I don't want to be immortal if it means living forever. 'Cause then everybody else just die and get old in front of you while you stay the same. And that's just sad.
Then she smiled.
But maybe I'll come back as some HeLa cells like my mother. And that way, we can do good together out there in the world.
She paused and nodded again.
I think I'd like that.
Where they are now. Alfred Carter Jr., Deborah's son, is in prison, serving a 30-year sentence for robbery with a dangerous and deadly weapon and first-degree assault with a handgun. While incarcerated, he went through drug and alcohol rehabilitation, got his GED, and taught GED classes to other inmates for $25 a month. In 2006, he wrote to the judge who sentenced him, saying he wanted to pay back the money he stole and needed to know who to send it to. Dr. Sir Lord Keenan Kester Cofield's whereabouts are unknown. Most recently, he served several years in prison for trying to buy jewelry at Macy's with a stolen check and filed several lawsuits while incarcerated. In 2008, after being released from prison, Cofield filed a 75-page lawsuit, his last to date, that a judge called incomprehensible. He sued 226 parties for more than $10 billion and argued that past decisions in all his cases should be reversed in his favor and that anyone who printed his name without permission should be included in his suit because he'd copyrighted his name. I was never able to get in touch with him to interview him for this book. Cliff Garrett, Henrietta's cousin, lived in his farmhouse in Clover until 2009, when his failing health required him to move in with his son in Richmond, Virginia, where he currently lives. HeLa is still one of the most commonly used cell lines in laboratories around the world. When this book went to press in 2009, more than 60,000 scientific articles had been published about research done on HeLa, and that number was increasing steadily at a rate of more than 300 papers each month. HeLa cells are still contaminating other cultures and causing an estimated several million dollars in damage each year. Howard Jones, Henrietta's doctor, is an emeritus professor at Johns Hopkins and Eastern Virginia Medical School. He founded the Jones Institute for Reproductive Medicine in Norfolk, Virginia, with his late wife, Georgiana. They were pioneers in the field of infertility treatments and were responsible for the first test tube baby born in the United States. When this book went to press, he was 99 years old. Mary Kubitschek is retired and living in Maryland. Zakaria, Sonny, and Lawrence Lax were deeply affected by Deborah's death. Lawrence charged more than $6,000 to his credit cards to cover the cost of her burial. And when this book went to press, Sonny was saving money to buy her a tombstone. Zakaria stopped drinking and began studying the lives of yogis and others who'd achieved inner peace. He started spending more time with his family, including his many nieces and nephews, who hug and kiss him on a regular basis. He smiles often. Sonny has sworn to uphold Deborah's desire to gain recognition for their mother. Today, when the Lax brothers talk about Henrietta, they focus on the importance of her contribution to science. They no longer talk about suing Johns Hopkins, though Lawrence and Zakaria still believe they're owed a share of the profits from HeLa cells. Christoph Langauer is global head of oncology drug discovery at Sanofi Aventis, one of the biggest pharmaceutical companies in the world. Many of the scientists working for him use HeLa cells on a routine basis. He lives in Paris, France. Davon Mead and little Alfred Jr., Deborah's grandsons, live in Baltimore, as do 22 of Henrietta's other descendants, including her grandchildren, great-grandchildren, and great-great-grandchildren. Two others live in California. John Moore appealed to the U.S. Supreme Court, which refused to hear his case. He died in 2001. Roland Patillo is a professor at Morehouse School of Medicine, where he continues to hold his HeLa conference in Henrietta's honor each year. Patillo and his wife, Pat, plan to buy a marker for Henrietta's grave to be placed near her mother's tombstone in the Lacks family cemetery. James Pullum, Deborah's ex-husband, is still preaching in Baltimore. Courtney Speed still runs her grocery store, where she continues to teach local children to do math and hopes to open a Henrietta Lacks Museum. Afterward. When I tell people the story of Henrietta Lacks and her cells, their first question is usually, wasn't it illegal for doctors to take Henrietta's cells without her knowledge? Don't doctors have to tell you when they use your cells in research? The answer is no. Not in 1951, and not in 2009 when this book went to press. Today, most Americans have their tissue on file somewhere. When you go to the doctor for a routine blood test or to have a mole removed, when you have an appendectomy, tonsillectomy, or any other kind of ectomy, the stuff you leave behind doesn't always get thrown out. Doctors, hospitals, and laboratories keep it, often indefinitely. In 1999, the RAND Corporation published a report, the first and so far last of its kind, with a conservative estimate that more than 307 million tissue samples from more than 178 million people were stored in the United States alone. This number, the report said, was increasing by more than 20 million samples each year. The samples come from routine medical procedures, tests, operations, clinical trials, and research donations. They sit in lab freezers, on shelves, or in industrial vats of liquid nitrogen. They're stored at military facilities, the FBI, and the National Institutes of Health. They're in biotech company labs and most hospitals. Biobanks store appendixes, ovaries, skin, sphincters, testicles, fat, even foreskins from most circumcisions. They also house blood samples taken from most infants born in the United States since the late 60s, when states started mandating the screening of all newborns for genetic diseases. And the scale of tissue research is only getting bigger. It used to be some researcher in Florida had 60 samples in his freezer, then another guy in Utah had some in his, says Kathy Hudson, a molecular biologist who founded the Genetics and Public Policy Center at Johns Hopkins University and is now chief of staff at NIH. Now we're talking about a massive, massive scale. In 2009, the NIH invested $13.5 million to develop a bank for the samples taken from newborns nationwide. A few years ago, the National Cancer Institute started gathering what it expects will be millions of tissue samples for mapping cancer genes. The Genographic Project began doing the same to map human migration patterns, as did the NIH to track disease genes. And for several years, the public has been sending samples by the millions to personalized DNA testing companies like 23andMe, which only provide customers with their personal medical or genealogical information if they first sign a form granting permission for their samples to be stored for future research. Scientists use these samples to develop everything from flu vaccines to penis enlargement products. They put cells in culture dishes and expose them to radiation, drugs, cosmetics, viruses, household chemicals, and biological weapons, and then study their responses. Without those tissues, we would have no tests for diseases like hepatitis and HIV, no vaccines for rabies, smallpox, measles, none of the promising new drugs for leukemia, breast cancer, colon cancer. And developers of the products that rely on human biological materials would be out billions of dollars. How you should feel about all this isn't obvious. It's not as if scientists are stealing your arm or some vital organ. They're using tissue scraps you parted with voluntarily. Still, often that involves someone taking part of you. And people often have a strong sense of ownership when it comes to their bodies, even tiny scraps of them, especially when they hear that someone else might be making money off those scraps or using them to uncover potentially damaging information about their genes and medical histories. But a feeling of ownership doesn't hold up in court. And at this point, no case law has fully clarified whether you own or have the right to control your tissues. When they're part of your body, they're clearly yours. Once they're excised, your rights get murky. Kathy Hudson, who has conducted focus groups about the public's feelings on the tissue issue, says she believes that tissue rights have the potential to become a bona fide movement. "I could see people starting to say, 'No, you can't take my tissues,' she told me. 'All I can say is, we better deal with the problems now instead of waiting until that happens.'" There are, essentially, two issues to deal with: consent and money. For most people, knowing if and how their tissues are being used in research is a far bigger issue than profiting from them. Yet when this book went to press, storing blood and tissues for research did not legally require informed consent, because the law governing such things doesn't generally apply to tissue research. The Federal Policy for the Protection of Human Subjects, also known as the Common Rule, requires informed consent for all human subject research. But in practice, most tissue research isn't covered because, one, it's not federally funded, or two, the researcher never learns the identity of the donors or has firsthand contact with them, in which case it's not considered research on humans. So in the end, the Common Rule doesn't actually govern most tissue research. Today, if doctors want to gather tissues from patients strictly for research purposes, as in Henrietta's case, they are required to get informed consent. But storing tissues from diagnostic procedures, like, say, mole biopsies, and using them in future research doesn't require such consent. Most institutions still choose to get permission. But there's no uniformity in the way that's done. A few hand out enough information to fill a small book, explaining exactly what will be done with all patient tissues. But most just include a short line in an admission form saying that any tissues removed may be used for education or research. According to Judith Greenberg, director of the Division of Genetics and Developmental Biology at the National Institute of General Medical Science, the NIH now has very stringent guidelines requiring consent for any tissues collected for their banks. It's very important for donors to understand what the consequences of tissue research might be, she says. But their guidelines apply only to NIH research, and they're not legally binding. Supporters of the status quo argue that passing new tissue-specific legislation is unnecessary and that the current oversight practices are enough. They point to institutional review boards, the many professional guidelines, like the American Medical Association's Code of Ethics, which requires doctors to inform patients if their tissue samples will be used in research or lead to profits, and several post-Nuremberg codes, including the Declaration of Helsinki and the Belmont Report, all of which list consent as a requirement. But guidelines and ethical codes aren't laws, and many tissue rights supporters say internal review doesn't work. Beyond simply knowing their tissues are being used in research, some tissue rights activists believe donors should have the right to say, for example, that they don't want their tissues used for research on nuclear weapons, abortion, racial differences, intelligence, or anything else that might run contrary to their beliefs. They also believe it's important for donors to be able to control who has access to their tissues, because they worry that information gathered from tissue samples might be used against them. In 2005, members of the Native American Havasupai tribe sued Arizona State University after scientists took tissue samples the tribe donated for diabetes research and used them without consent to study schizophrenia and inbreeding. Their case is still pending. In 2006, some 700 new mothers found out that doctors had taken their placentas without consent to test for abnormalities that might help the hospital defend itself against future lawsuits over birth defects. And in a handful of cases, genetic tests performed on people without their consent have been used to deny workers' compensation or health insurance claims, something now protected against by the Genetic Information Non-Discrimination Act of 2008. Because of cases like these, a growing number of activists, ethicists, lawyers, doctors, and patients are arguing cases and pushing for new regulations that would grant people the right to control their tissues. And a growing number of tissue donors are suing for control of their samples and the DNA inside them. In 2005, 6,000 patients demanded that Washington University remove their tissue samples from its prostate cancer bank. The university refused, and the samples were tied up in litigation for years. So far, two courts have ruled against the patients, relying on the same logic used in the Moore case, that giving patients those rights would inhibit research, etc. In 2008, the patients appealed to the Supreme Court, which refused to hear their case. When this book went to press, they were contemplating class action. Most recently, in July 2009, parents in Minnesota and Texas sued to stop the nationwide practice of storing and conducting research, without consent, on fetal blood samples, many of which can be traced back to the infants they came from. They argue that research on those samples is an invasion of their children's privacy. Because of the Health Insurance Portability and Accountability Act, HIPAA, of 1996, there is now clear federal law in place to prevent the kind of privacy violation that happened to the Lacks family when doctors at Hopkins released Henrietta's name and her medical records. Since tissues connected to their donors' names are subject to strict regulation under the Common Rule, samples are no longer named using donor initials as Henrietta's cells were. Today, they're usually identified by code numbers. But as Judith Greenberg of the NIH says, it's never possible to 100% guarantee anonymity, because in theory, we can now sequence genes and find out who anyone is from their cells. So the consent process has to be more about laying out the risks of tissue research so people can decide whether they want to participate. Ellen Wright Clayton, a physician and lawyer who is director of the Center for Biomedical Ethics and Society at Vanderbilt University, says there needs to be a very public conversation about all of this. She says, if someone presented a bill in Congress that said, as of today, when you go to the doctor for health care, your medical records and tissue samples can be used for research and nobody has to ask you, if the issue were stated that bluntly so people could really understand what's happening and say they're okay with it, that would make me more comfortable with what we're currently doing. Because what's happening now is not what people think is going on. Lori Andrews, director of the Institute for Science, Law, and Technology at the Illinois Institute of Technology, wants something more drastic. She has called for people to get policymakers' attention by becoming conscientious objectors in the DNA draft and refusing to give tissue samples. David Korn, vice provost for research at Harvard University, argues that giving patients control over their tissues is short-sighted. "Sure," he says, "consent feels nice. Letting people decide what's going to happen with their tissues seems like the right thing to do. But consent diminishes the value of tissue." To illustrate this, Korn points to the Spanish flu pandemic. In the 1990s, scientists used stored tissue samples from a soldier who died in 1918 to recreate the virus's genome and study why it was so deadly, with hopes of uncovering information about the current avian flu. In 1918, asking that soldier's permission to take tissues for this kind of future research would have been impossible, Korn says. It was an inconceivable question. No one even knew what DNA was. For Korn, the consent issue is overshadowed by a public responsibility to science. "I think people are morally obligated to allow their bits and pieces to be used to advance knowledge to help others. Since everybody benefits, everybody can accept the small risks of having their tissue scraps used in research." The only exception he would make is for people whose religious beliefs prohibit tissue donation. "If somebody says being buried without all their pieces will condemn them to wandering forever because they can't get salvation, that's legitimate, and people should respect it," Korn says. But he acknowledges that people can't raise those objections if they don't understand their tissues are being used in the first place. "Science is not the highest value in society," Andrews says, pointing instead to things like autonomy and personal freedom. "Think about it," she says. "I decide who gets my money after I die. It wouldn't harm me if I died and you gave all my money to someone else. But there's something psychologically beneficial to me as a living person to know I can give my money to whoever I want. No one can say she shouldn't be allowed to do that with her money because that might not be most beneficial to society. But replace the word money in that sentence with tissue, and you've got precisely the logic many people use to argue against giving donors any control over their tissues." Wayne Grody, director of the Diagnostic Molecular Pathology Laboratory at the University of California, Los Angeles, was once a fierce opponent of consent for tissue research. But after years of debating people like Andrews and Clayton, he's become more moderate. "I'm pretty convinced that we should go the extra mile to have a good and complex consent process," he told me. Still, he can't imagine how it would work. "These tissues enter a pipeline of millions of other samples," he said. "How are you going to distinguish, well, this patient said we can study colon cancer, the next one said we can do anything we want, but we can't commercialize it? I mean, do they all have to be color-coded?" Regardless, Grody stresses that questions of consent should apply only to the collection of future samples, not the millions already stored, including HeLa. "What are we going to do?" he says. "Throw them all out?" If the issue of consent isn't addressed, Robert Weir, founder of the Biomedical Ethics Center at the University of Iowa, sees only one outcome. Patients turn to law as a last resort when they don't see their participation being acknowledged. Weir favors fewer lawsuits and more disclosure. "Let's get these things on the table and come up with legal guidelines we can all live with," he says, "because going to court is the only other option." And court is where these cases often end up, particularly when they involve money. When it comes to money, the question isn't whether human tissues and tissue research will be commercialized. They are and will continue to be. Without commercialization, companies wouldn't make the drugs and diagnostic tests so many of us depend on. The question is how to deal with this commercialization, whether scientists should be required to tell people their tissues may be used for profit,
and where the people who donate those raw materials fit into that marketplace. It's illegal to sell human organs and tissues for transplants or medical treatments, but it's perfectly legal to give them away while charging fees for collecting and processing them. Industry-specific figures don't exist, but estimates say one human body can bring in anywhere from $10,000 to nearly $150,000. But it's extremely rare for individual cells from one person to be worth millions, like John Moore's. In fact, just as one mouse or one fruit fly isn't terribly useful for research, most individual cell lines and tissue samples aren't worth anything on their own. Their value for science comes from being part of a larger collection. Today, tissue supply companies range from small private businesses to huge corporations like Ardeus, which pays the Beth Israel Deaconess Medical Center, Duke University Medical Center, and many others an undisclosed amount of money for exclusive access to tissues collected from their patients. You can't ignore this issue of who gets the money and what the money is used for, says Clayton. I'm not sure what to do about it, but I'm pretty sure it's weird to say everybody gets money except the people providing the raw material. Various policy analysts, scientists, philosophers, and ethicists have suggested ways to compensate tissue donors, creating a Social Security-like system in which each donation entitles a person to increasing levels of compensation, giving donors tax write-offs, developing a royalty system like the one used for compensating musicians when their songs are played on the radio, requiring that a percentage of profits from tissue research go to scientific or medical charities, or that all of it be funneled back into research. Experts on both sides of the debate worry that compensating patients would lead to profit seekers inhibiting science by insisting on unrealistic financial agreements or demanding money for tissues used in non-commercial or non-profit research. But in the majority of cases, tissue donors haven't gone after profits at all. They, like most tissue rights activists, are less concerned about personal profits than about making sure the knowledge scientists gain by studying tissues is available to the public and to other researchers. In fact, several patient groups have created their own tissue banks so they can control the use of their tissues and the patenting of discoveries related to them. And one woman became a patent holder on the disease gene discovered in her children's tissues, which lets her determine what research is done on it and how it's licensed. Gene patents are the point of greatest concern in the debate over ownership of human biological materials and how that ownership might interfere with science. As of 2005, the most recent year figures were available, the U.S. government had issued patents relating to the use of about 20% of known human genes, including genes for Alzheimer's, asthma, colon cancer, and most famously, breast cancer. This means pharmaceutical companies, scientists, and universities control what research can be done on those genes and how much resulting therapies and diagnostic tests will cost. And some enforce their patents aggressively. Myriad Genetics, which holds the patents on the BRCA1 and BRCA2 genes responsible for most cases of hereditary breast and ovarian cancer, charges $3,000 to test for the genes. Myriad has been accused of creating a monopoly, since no one else can offer the test, and researchers can't develop cheaper tests or new therapies without getting permission from Myriad and paying steep licensing fees. Scientists who've gone ahead with research involving the breast cancer genes without Myriad's permission have found themselves on the receiving end of cease and desist letters and threats of litigation. In May 2009, the American Civil Liberties Union, several breast cancer survivors, and professional groups representing more than 150,000 scientists sued Myriad Genetics over its breast cancer gene patents. Among other things, scientists involved in the case claim that the practice of gene patenting has inhibited their research, and they aim to stop it. The presence of so many scientists in the suit, many of them from top institutions, challenges the standard argument that ruling against biological patents would interfere with scientific progress. Lori Andrews, who has worked pro bono on all of the most important biological ownership cases to date, including the current breast cancer gene suit, says that many scientists have interfered